Welcome to the General Carey Podcast. Today's episode is with Charles Bronfman. Charles Bronfman, the former owner of the Montreal Expos. He owned the team from 1969 through till 1991. He was also a member, of course, of the illustrious Bronfman family of Seagram's fame. His brother Edgar was the CEO of the company, as was his father. And he has a new book called Distilled, in which he talks about his relationships with his family, the Seagram's fortune, his time with the Montreal Expos, and all that stuff. Interesting read for sure. And so we got into all that stuff, his family history, time with the Expos, lots of things like that. I first met Charles when I interviewed him for my Expos book, Up, Up, and Away, which is great if you haven't read it, by the way. I guess that's self-aggrandizing. I think it's great. Maybe you will. And it was an interesting chat then, so I was eager to follow up with him this time, and I hope that you enjoy this interesting and far-reaching conversation. Also, coming off of a weekend in Cooperstown, I just want to say a sincere thank you to, everybody who made this past weekend really great. Random people chatting in the street, to good friends that I got to see. Got to see my family, hung out with my family, which was nice. And yeah, it meant a lot. Tim Raines, in his induction speech, said some nice things about me, which was overwhelming and completely unnecessary and kind of untrue, since he would have gotten into the Hall of Fame even if I never existed on Earth. But it was really nice of him to give me credit and say all the nice things that he did, and I really, really appreciate it. He is a swell guy, and I'm very happy for him that he's in the Hall of Fame. It was a pretty cool, pretty emotional weekend all around, and all the more good. His plaque is now resting in Cooperstown alongside Babe Ruth and Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and everybody else. Pretty neat. So yeah, enjoy this episode of the Jonah Carey Podcast. It is with Charles Bronfman. I mean, vaguely close to your face, but whatever's comfortable. And we're already starting. It's very simple and casual.
Okay.
I was saying to you before that I found the book to have a lot of... It was called Distilled, and I found the book to have a lot of humanity in it in a way that you don't know you're going to get. You know, when there's kind of a titan of industry and, oh, let me tell you about my conquests. Let me tell you about how great I am. And almost from page one, it's, these are my insecurities. These are the things that I dealt with, as you said, well into your 30s. And I'm wondering, when you were setting the tone for this thing, if that was sort of a stated goal. Oh, I'm going to lay it all bare and make clear that I'm, you know, I've had a lot of difficulties in my life.
Well, I think I decided if I was going to do a biography at my tender age,
yeah,
I might just as well tell the truth. And so I decided to do that, number one, so that my grandchildren would really know who their pops was,
mm-hmm.
although I was going to do a private thing just for them.
Oh.
But then I said, you know, there are a lot of lessons to be learned from my life, that whether you're wealthy or not wealthy, there are sibling stuff and family relationships and business and family business and slow starters who can overcome their own deficiencies. A lot of stuff.
And as far as slow starters and so forth, you know, obviously in some ways you're afforded obvious advantages when you come from an area of security, just knowing, okay, this is where my next meal is going to come from and so forth. But in terms of self-esteem and really figuring out who you are and all that, it seems like these things are connected, that being somewhat sheltered and also having to live up to the standard of your father, who was a great man, I would imagine that would have to be very difficult.
Well, for some, in some families, it's easier. And for
me,
yeah, that was tough, except I never wanted to conquer him. I knew I couldn't.
Yeah.
And so I never wanted to get into a father-son fight. My brother, unfortunately, did.
Yeah.
Which caused problems insoluble problems, which I say later on in his life, well, I started doing better.
Yeah.
And then came the denouement, as we say, and that was very difficult.
And then as far as just the day-to-day, God, one thing that struck me, it was a little detail, but you were talking about the way the children play. You know, that you go to the park and you see your chums and so forth, and that wasn't afforded to you. You couldn't just tootle off to the park. You had to be at your own place, and you couldn't necessarily get the kids from the neighborhood to come visit. You know, at the time, whatever existence you have is obviously that's your version of normal. But did you ever step outside yourself and say, I wish I was on the slides? I wish I was doing this thing when you were 9 or 12 or 15?
Well, actually, by the time we were 12 and 14 or 15, we did do that. We would take our bikes and we'd go to a neighboring street and we'd have fun with our neighbors.
Right.
So, you know, I don't think we knew we were living a restricted life. At least I didn't.
Right.
And I couldn't get very impressed with the idea that we lived in a bigger house than our friends did.
Right.
All these things were sort of, okay, that's what it is.
Right. And then, you know, you talk about the way that confidence has developed, and I was struck by the way that you got into the family business. One thing that I want to get to before we jump to that is you were at McGill, and you made the decision to leave McGill. Now, again, there's a huge caveat here, which is that you have a safety net financially. If you were not in college, that's fine. But this generation in particular, it seems to me, wrestles with that a little bit because there's entrepreneurs and kids who are 17 can make a doodad and then they are a dot-com billionaire. And it's a funny thing about that. And so I'm wondering, you know, it feels like the status quo is to say, and, you know, education is great. Make sure to get an education and so forth. But it worked out for you. I know many people who don't have that wealth. It worked out for them. You know, what do you see as the pluses and minuses of going down the traditional path of I'm going to get my BA or my MBA and so forth? You obviously didn't go in that direction.
Well, it wasn't that I didn't go, it was I couldn't go.
Yeah.
Because I was going to fail, and my doctor said to my dad, you better get him the hell out of there.
Huh.
And so I got out of there. But I think for most people, they want to go into business, an MBA is a very good thing to have. Because you learn an awful lot, and particularly if you use the case study method, it's damn good because you start to understand the way the real world works.
Right.
One of the problems about staying too long in university is you're always in business for yourself, and you don't realize that when you're out of there, you're going to have to work with people, you have to work on teams, and it's the team that matters. That's why sports is so important. It's the team that matters. And I think that's why I've always sort of liked playing sports, because I love being on a team.
And then, as you said, case studies, you obviously went the practical way. You started working for Adams, one of the divisions of Seagram's, and it wasn't a powerhouse necessarily, and you were able to really revive it and make some things work.
Yeah, but that was my Harvard Business School.
Well, right. That was basically your case study.
It was. And what I did was we lost money the first year, but never again. And I remember saying to my colleagues at the Adams Company who were worried about competing with Seagram's VO, and I said to them one day, you know, it's very nice of you guys to worry about my family, but that doesn't put any money in your pocket now. To hell with Seagram's VO, you go out and sell Adams Antique against it. And we had a lot of fun in being down and dirty and improving ourselves and myself to be able to fight at any level you want to fight.
And it's discussed in the book, but take me through a little bit. What does down and dirty look like 60 years ago in the liquor business? How are you
finding that? Well, in Canada, it really meant that you give an extra bottle a case or something like
that.
And so we'd do that, and if somebody was giving $2 a case incentive or a bottle, we'd give $3.
Yeah.
We had to put ourselves on the map somehow because we really weren't known. It was fun. And I lived through all kinds of stuff. There was one guy who we caught stealing from us.
Wow.
And we didn't know who it was. And then my colleague in Ontario found out who it was, and I remember going to Toronto And the guy from the credit company, bonding company, he was there. He had the coldest blue eyes I'd ever seen.
Huh.
And this poor guy was in the room. He had been a football player.
Yeah.
And this guy was just looking at him, and I finally looked at him, and I said, so-and-so, you say that you love the sales manager. If you really do, tell me the full amount. And he did.
Hmm.
And we had another fella who everybody thought was in on the scheme because the former football player, unfortunately, wasn't bright enough to figure it all out.
Right.
And this other man was, but we couldn't prove it. He turned out to be the most loyal, wonderful guy for the rest of his career.
And I guess judging people would be a big part of that, and management style would be a big part of it. And you talked about the differences between you and your brother, Edgar, that he was a top-down approach, you know, that he saw himself as that kind of CEO, whereas you wanted to learn everything. You wanted to learn from the bottom up, and you wanted to get your hands dirty in parts of the business. Tell me about the advantages and disadvantages of both. I've heard that both of those methods can be successful when it comes to running a company.
Yeah, they can be successful. I think it depends on your personality.
Right.
As to which way you want to go. I was never a money student. I was a people student. And I think Edgar was more of a money student. And God bless him. That was fine with me.
And also just, I love your description of the four of you growing up, that you each had an archetype and that you were the pleaser. Mm-hmm. Not for nothing, but I consider myself to be that way too. I'm not a combative person at all. When you have that ingrained in you, though, and you're trying to run a business, you're trying to, certainly somebody's stealing from you, but even if you're trying to be hard-nosed, how do you balance that pleaser personality with, you know what, I got to get a little tough sometimes?
Well, you just do it. I mean, even a pleaser doesn't please all the time.
True.
You stand for what you stand for.
Yeah.
And I don't brook any nonsense. I never did for that kind of thing. I'll never forget one time when I was pretty darn young, and the chair of the Canadian company, and I would go to these industry meetings. And he came, and he said to me one day, "Oh, Charles, it's wonderful. Everybody loves you in the industry." And I said, "Jim, there's the heck they wouldn't. The day you say somebody's scared of me, then I'll know I'm doing a good job."
Huh. Well, and of course, that was, to some extent, Edgar's personality, but certainly your dad's personality. I mean, very much what you think of as that sort of grand titan of industry, ruling with an iron fist and so forth. Considering that wasn't your personality, were there still lessons to take away from the way your dad went about it?
Oh, yeah. He knew everything about his business.
Right.
He just knew it all. And I used to ask a colleague in Canada who was headed up our production. I said, "Jack, how long would it take the boss if he really wanted to catch us?" And don't forget, he would spend 4.5 days in New York at that time.
Yeah.
And half a day in Canada. And he said, and asked me that question, he said, "Oh, maybe 2 minutes."
Wow.
And it was true. I mean, the man, I remember one time we had an agent in the province of Canada where nobody lives called Newfoundland.
Yes.
And if you've seen the play Come From Away, it's a great play about how the 7,000 inhabitants of Gander, Newfoundland, dealt with the 7,000 people who came in 9/11 and the day after.
Yes.
On all those aircraft. And this man came in, he was our agent, very, very nice man. And he sat down with my dad, and I was in his office because it was part of my responsibility. And Dad started asking questions, "How's this brand going? How's that brand going?" And he tripped up this agent of ours who was selling in Newfoundland. Now, at that time, maybe Canada was responsible for 8% of our total business. Newfoundland was about 2% of our Canadian business, and yet my dad knew the numbers.
It's an amazing thing to be that detail-oriented.
In New York, go figure.
Yeah, to be that detail-oriented is just incredible. And the other thing that struck me, you know, there was a paradox with your dad, because in terms of parenting style, you know, there was a little bit of instilling fear. Like, it didn't seem like he had that different a personality as a father than he did as a CEO. At least that's the way that I read it. And I'm wondering, you know, you raised a family yourself, of course. Did you go a different way? Did you take a softer touch with, you know, "Oh, I have Stephen now. Okay, so do
no,
other lessons?"
No, I was softer. So.
Yeah.
But Stephen happened to have been a tough kid to bring up.
Huh.
I was malleable when I was a kid.
Right.
My daughter was also easy to bring up. Stephen was a rebel.
Hmm.
And I remember one time he said to me, he was 4 years old, he said, "You're not the boss of me, I'm the boss of myself." And then later on in life, when I asked him what he wanted to do, he said, "I want to walk into your office one day," and said, "Dad, this is what I'm going to do, and you don't know anything about it."
Did you appreciate that independent streak, or did it kind of take you aback? Oh, you liked it.
It made him tougher to bring up, but he sort of knew that he'd make it.
Hmm.
And I remember his mother and I would always have discussions, so we say. She thought that he would do something terrible to himself, and I would say to her, "He's never going to do that. He'll go to the edge. He'll never go over the cliff."
It's interesting about empowering children in that way. I've got young children myself, and just figuring it out, do you allow them to fail? Maybe you do. Maybe the idea of, oh, I'm going to solve their problems is unrealistic, I guess.
I think you solve their problems up to a certain age or a certain amount of problems.
Yes.
And then you figure, well, if they're going to keep on doing it, let them find out the hard way.
And the idea of confidence as well, you said in the book, and I've heard you say it in other places, that it was honestly owning a baseball team that had a lot to do with it, that your mother was pushing you to be part of the symphony, which you hated. This is a famous story that you've told. And that this was your thing, that, you know, Seagram's came, your dad was, you ended up having responsibility there too, but that had come from him. And that the symphony was your mother's thing, and that this was your thing and your way to make it in the world. But you also talked about just the self-assurance of having mastery over something. This was something over which it seemed that you had mastery when you owned the baseball team.
Well, I had not mastery of the team because, you know, the professionals ran the team.
Sure, yeah.
I was the biggest fan, of course. But just knowing that I could be the front person for the team,
right,
and I could handle the media, and I could put the face on the team that hopefully would sell a lot of tickets, that meant a lot to me.
And also, you know, with owners, I think for those of us who have not owned a sports franchise, which is the vast majority of us, there's sort of a question of why you do it. That one would be, maybe it's an ego stroke. It's, oh, I get to do this. And one would be financial. You know, maybe there's money to be made. Turned out there was in your case. But I was so struck in the book. And the first time that I met you, you talked about this too. You just really love Canada. And it was such a point. You're crying on opening day in 1969. Take me through that day of the first game, and you're with the Prime Minister and with Drapeau, and this is happening, and what went through your mind?
Well, the first game actually was here in New York.
Right, in New York. Then it was in Montreal,
The Prime Minister wasn't there, but I was seeing Mr. Drapeau. And Maureen Forrester, great soprano, was sang O Canada with the band from the Collège Militaire Royal, which
came up to New York. Wow.
And there were 40,000 Americans standing on their feet for our anthem.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, that was something else. The other thing I remember about that game was very funny. It's funny the things you remember.
Yeah.
There's Drapeau looking at me, and he pointed to the sky, and there was an airplane going over Shea Stadium. He said, "How can they allow that? Having an airplane go over while baseball's going on?" He said, "It never happened in Montreal." he would put the stadium somewhere else. And he certainly did.
He sure did.
Terrible location.
Well, we need to talk
about an awful stadium.
both of the ballparks had flaws, and the first one was such an interesting story, and I discuss it in my book a little bit too. But for people who don't know what Jarry Park was before it became a baseball stadium, it was nothing, right? It was a couple of rickety bleachers, basically.
Yeah, I never saw it even.
Yeah.
I did see it after Warren Giles had looked at it with Russ Taylor, and there was another Desjardins, I think.
Yeah.
and they had taken him to it. I didn't even know anything was going on. And he said, yes, it could become a ballpark. I don't know if he said major league. But and there had been apparently some junior game going on that night.
Yeah.
And it was fabulous. Even the seats were the wrong facing the wrong way. They're facing towards the outfield. And most of the action in baseball is in the
infield. Yeah.
But they're facing the outfield. I spent hours, literally, trying to figure out how the heck could you double deck this thing and play football and baseball.
Oh.
And the problem was, and the multi-purpose idiot in this country found that out. Football is measured in yards.
Yeah.
Baseball in feet. And that's it. That's really the defining. And Canadian football had a larger end zone than American football.
Right.
And I think it also had 110 yards Correct. Versus 100. So it made it even more difficult to fit both into the same arena.
And just to underscore some stories from Jerry Park, one of my favorites is there were basically 8 months to turn this into a stadium 10 times the size of what it was.
Right.
And because there was such horrendous weather and it was such a quick schedule, the night before, there were chairs brought in from a funeral home which were being unfolded.
I didn't know that.
Yes, that's right. Well, and I've talked to Dave Van Horn about this too. And my favorite is, it's not just that there were, I don't know, 6,000 chairs from a funeral home. It's that Jim Fanning was one of the people who was unfolding them. Now, Jim Fanning was a do-it-all guy and a wonderful human being and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But if you can imagine the Theo Epstein equivalent getting into Wrigley Field and unfolding 6,000 chairs the night before, that just slays me.
Unfortunately, in those days, there was no Theo Epstein.
No.
Nor anybody who thought that way.
No, not at all.
One of the problems, I think, in those days was they were all old-fashioned ball people.
Yeah.
I remember one time in spring training, Andre Scalaraga was having a very tough time. And I went to Murray Cook. He couldn't even get the ball out of the infield.
Yeah.
I went to Murray Cook and I said, what the hell's the matter with Andre? Oh, he said he's just a happy-go-lucky Venezuelan. Then I spoke to the trainer. I said, Gallo's having a terrible time hitting the ball out of the infield. He said, well, he should. I said, what do you mean? He said, that guy is standing in the batting practice for hours on end at his hands are like raw meat.
Oh!
No, there's the difference. There's the guy who knows, the guy who doesn't know.
Yeah.
Because they had, in baseball, they had all these prejudices about who was a white ball player, a black ball player. Mm-hmm. Did you come from California? Did you come from the South? Were you a Latin ball player? And everybody was stereotyped, which was nuts.
Yeah.
Nuts.
It came up with Felipe Alou, too, who was clearly a brilliant baseball man, but it took him so long to get the job that he deserved.
I remember asking about him.
Yeah.
And I asked the guys, I said, you know, there's this manager at Class A in Palm Beach, Felipe Alou, why don't we give him a shot? Oh, no, he couldn't handle the media, he couldn't handle
Oh, jeez.
Yeah,
yeah, that stuff is really difficult.
And yet, he can't impose. I could never have said, well, I don't give a damn, you're going to make Felipe Alou the manager. They would have found a way to get rid of him.
Yeah, as you...
Because that sort of thing, you either are going to be a Steinbrenner or you're going to be a Bronfman. And never the twain shall meet.
And as you said, you didn't really intervene in baseball matters. And the only time that you basically did was to say, we need to develop the best farm system because free agents weren't going to come to Montreal. And you could tell people about what was the first step that you made when you decided you were going to make that move, the meeting that you had in Palm Beach with all the employees. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, we had all the coaches and the managers and everybody from the executives from the minor leagues. Not the managers, and not the field personnel, but the others.
Player development staff.
Player development staff.
Yeah.
And I got the approval from my partners and from John McHale, our president. And I told them that we were going to have the best farm team in baseball, or farm system in baseball, and that we were going to pay more than anybody else. But they either have to cut it or they're going to be gone.
Yep.
And we're going to have standards for everybody and so on. And of course they thought it was a bunch of nonsense. Here's some rich guy saying whatever he had to say until the checks came in at the end of the month.
25% raise across the board.
That's right.
I mean, and I cannot imagine, I've never heard of another franchise do it. And it worked. That's
and
the
it
thing.
Worked.
It worked. Dawson, Carter, Raines, Cromartie, Valentine, Rogers, all these guys came through. And as far as just the personal excitement on your level, move from Jerry Park to the Big O. The Big O, we could talk forever. We don't have forever. But the players coming through once the new ballpark opened, did you just sort of sit back one day and say, yes, finally, my vision has come to fruition?
No, I was just anxious to win
yeah.
and get in the World Series. That was the important thing. and we came so close. It's the only thing I wish we could have, the Blue Monday would have been erased.
Yeah.
And that we would have won that against the Dodgers, because we would have beaten the Yankees just as they did.
Expos were a better team that year.
We were a better team.
It's an interesting thing to me, too, because if you go back and look at those years when they came to 79, 80, these are strong years. If the wild card were transposed back to then, this would have been like four playoff berths in a row, something like that.
By the way, I argued for, not necessarily the wild card, I argued for expanding the playoffs to two teams from each division.
Yeah.
Because, and people would look at me sort of screwy and say, why do you want to do that? And I said, well, it's a matter of being in contention.
I said,
I've been in contention in my town. I've been not in contention. And it's a huge, huge difference. We have a chance. We have a chance. People get all fired up.
Yeah.
And I said, we don't own this damn game. And the players don't own it. The people own it. So why do we cater to the people?
It's a logical point of view.
And then I suggested cutting the season back to 154 games. Well, I'll tell you. It was like the end of the world had arrived.
Because that's less revenue. They're not happy about that.
I see these guys with their pencils and a piece of paper in their... jotting down, oh no, we can't do that. I lose so much. I said, you crazy? We'll make more. Everybody will make more.
Supply and demand.
Well, it's not just supply and demand. If you get an extra team in the in the playoffs, you get that much more cities, that much more excitement, that much revenue from that many more fans.
Hmm.
And to me, it was very simple. And I was, I guess, like Panasonic in those days, slightly ahead of my time.
Nice Panasonic reference. I also want to ask you, I love the story of Rusty Staub going to the Expos. And we could, I want to get your thoughts on Rusty in general, but basically the way it goes down is he's just, there's a trade that's been consummated with the Astros, but Bowie Kuhn has to come in. We say his name in hushed tones because we don't like Bowie Kuhn here. But he basically ends up in the complex, and you and Gene Mock and John McHale and Rusty just decide to pose for a picture, and then he's suddenly an Expo. That's how it's decided that it's going to be that way.
I had nothing to do with that. I was a pawn. that was all McHale. Gene Kirby.
Gene Kirby, sure.
Gene Kirby was our traveling secretary, yeah. Which was a stitch. He had more damn fun doing that. I think it was his... It was John's doing,
yeah.
Primarily. And I remember going down on the field. I was told I had to go down on the field. And there was McHale and Fanning and Staub and Mock.
Yeah.
And Kuhn. And I was standing next to Kuhn. And all of a sudden, a hand came and to my collar, caught me the hell away, and wound up with Kuhn and Staub. And Staub had his uniform on, number 10. And they're standing next to each other, and that picture went viral right across the country.
It's the original viral picture.
And that was the end of that.
It was beautiful.
And then what happened was, you recall that part of the trade was Don Clendenin.
Yes.
And Don Clendenin said he wouldn't report.
He worked for a pen company.
For Scripto.
Yes.
In Atlanta. So John McHale went to Atlanta, and he said, I just got Clendenin on a trade. I said, who did you trade for him? He said, Clendenin. And then, of course, we traded Clendenin to the Mets.
We had to play great.
He became the MVP of the World Series that year.
I just love the
amazing,
way...
Amazing.
Yeah, and I just love the way that baseball was operated in those days. Everything, you know, we talked about Theo Epstein and people like that are very admirable, but it was so seat of your pants back then. You know, you'd consummate in a trade in a bar. You would... things like, oh, he's in a picture, therefore he's on the team. These things would never happen now. Did that add, I mean, obviously you were in the era you were in, but just thinking about it, it seems like it would be a little bit more fun. Like you're getting your hands a little dirtier in that way, I guess.
Well, I don't know whether it was more fun. You know, baseball is so traditional, and the attitudes are so traditional. I mean, when a Theo Epstein came along, or Moneyball.
Yeah, Billy Bean. Yeah.
Billy Bean.
Yeah.
I mean, those were total revolutions.
Yes.
People went crazy.
Yes.
And it took those types of people to get a little bit more intelligent, because you take the draft picks. How the heck do you know with an 18-year-old kid whether his arm is going to get any better, whether his body's going to fill out, whether his emotions are right for that particular club, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You don't. So you got to somehow or other size people up an awful lot better than was done in my day.
No doubt. Did you have one guy? Was it Rusty or Dawson? Did you have one player that you sort of like, oh, that was my guy? You know, that you can look back after the fact, you could admit to, I really, really liked so-and-so.
Well, I really, really liked Stop.
Yeah.
I really liked him. He had that flair. He had the excitement. He could say, he looked like Casey at the bat, for God's sake.
Yeah,
he
the really red hair.
Yeah, the red hair and the way he stood at the bat.
Yeah.
He stood fairly erect. I can still see him. Of course, I do see him occasionally in West Palm Beach.
Yeah.
Where we had lunch together last year.
Oh, wonderful.
And he's very heavy.
Yeah. Well, the man could cook. He used to bring cooking utensils on the road. He's a gourmet and a gourmand.
Yes, he is both.
Yeah, no.
He likes wine, too.
He sure does.
That's his wine.
And he integrated himself so well to the city. Here's a guy who comes from New Orleans, and he's going to take up French. And Le Grand Arroche, he was truly beloved on this team that was bad that your son wore number 8, not for Boots Day, but for Willie Stargell. That people would root for the opposing team because the Expos weren't good, but at least it was a way to see Willie Mays come into town or
Willie
Stargell.
Yeah, but that was the idea.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we had a couple of has-beens.
Yeah.
When we did the draft, which was as it should be.
Of course.
We had some young kids who mostly never made it.
Yeah.
We had Coco LaVoy. They used to get around. Coco LaVoy played third base our first couple of years.
My grandfather hated Coco LaVoy.
And Coco LaGirl.
He was not a great ball player. But Mac Jones. I mean, there were guys that clicked.
Yeah, yeah.
It was an interesting thing. And then, you know, the Gary Carter thing is so layered and nuanced and complicated because as fans, you know, we love the guy. He was a great player, great smile and all this stuff. But it was a difficult thing. His teammates, they would famously call him Lights because when the lights went on, he would go to the camera and that he was, you know, he knew about self-promotion and so forth. And he was a good ball player. But from your point of view as an owner, here's a guy who's demanding $2 million a year, which is a heck of a lot of money back then. Maybe he's not the most popular player with his teammates, but he's also a franchise player, and you're stuck in this tough zone. So, you know, ultimately a decision gets made, we're going to trade this guy. How do you kind of reconcile all of it when thinking about that kind of decision? Because he was Rusty number 2 in some ways.
That was the only decision I ever made.
Yeah.
And I said to Mikhail and Fanny, I said, this is just crazy, we cannot keep Carter.
Right.
And they said, and I said, I don't like Carter. Frankly, I did not admire him as a player.
Hmm.
I think there was too much pressure on him in Montreal.
He was supposed
to be the star,
yeah.
The kid.
Yeah.
He was the offense. And I think there, and he wanted to star. He wanted to hit home runs.
Yeah.
He wanted to hit doubles and so on. He didn't understand the idea of man on second, slap the ball into right field, score the run.
Yeah.
I don't think that really occurred to him.
Hmm.
And but I don't know. But then when he came to the Mets, he was one of many.
Yes.
And he could start here because he was one of many. And he didn't have to be the star. There were other guys. And everybody had big ego here.
Right.
So, you know, he fit right in.
But the big
mistake I made was they offered us in that trade Mookie Wilson.
Oh, really?
And we took Herman Winningham. Why? Because I saw Winningham in September, and he looked so good.
We will briefly touch on the sad saga of Herm Winningham, just because you started to talk about Winningham over Mookie. Mookie would have been a good acquisition.
Well, I'm not so sure if Mookie would have, you know. And he did very well for the Mets.
He did.
After that. But I think for a Mookie who was so tied to New York, it could have been quite disruptive for him,
right,
emotionally. He might not have done so.
You didn't want to make the Maury Wills mistake. You wanted somebody who was there because he wanted to be there.
Right. And the problem was that Winningham had done very well in September.
Yep.
Played like hell, so I said, well, we're going to have a good young player rather than a guy who is really being kicked out by the Mets. A
couple broader questions. We just have a few left here. So, I want to give people a sense of what it was, and I've had Tim Raines on the podcast too.
Right.
I actually had this fellow, Mr. Trudeau, as well. A couple of weeks ago, I went over to Ottawa. It was great. I talked to Raines about what the atmosphere was like in that 81-82 period when the team was drawing 2 million fans. And I think, especially we're sitting here in New York, or even if you were in Milwaukee or Cleveland, people would say there's no way that the Expos played popular baseball. But it happened, right? I mean, that was the place to see and be seen in the early '80s.
Yeah, it was great. Even though it was a terrible ballpark,
Right.
The wrong location. And when a place like Montreal, just like Minnesota,
yeah,
when you're all huddled up together in the winter, and you know, and all of a sudden you know a string when you see a neighbor on the street,
yeah,
because you don't see anybody all winter.
Yeah.
You want to be outside in the summertime.
Yeah.
And so a retractable roof was absolutely mandatory, and of course ours didn't work.
Yeah.
So it became a fixed roof.
Yeah.
And that made it a big, huge barn. You know, well, you know.
I know.
The seats were configured wrong. It was, if you were in the 12th row, you were out of the park. You were not on the field. And the other thing was that baseball is a pastoral sport.
Yep.
You don't put it in a big, tough stadium.
No. Roger Taillibert.
Yeah.
Yes, not our favorite person either,
not,
I suppose.
Not at all. And Jean Drapeau and the Canadian system, where you don't have to go out for bond issues.
Jean Drapeau, shoot first and ask questions later.
Absolutely.
And you ended up selling the team. It officially became official in 1991. I want to ask you if there's any, you know, there's a movement now, right? You know this. Of course, your son has come out on the record and said that he might be interested in this. If it were to work, what is the difference between 2017 in Montreal and in MLB versus 1990 when it wasn't going to work? Why could it work now?
Because I think French Canada is much more sure of itself.
Uh-huh.
It is the boss in Montreal.
Yep.
It will decide the fate of teams. I think that they genuinely miss Major League Baseball. They want to have the panache of Major League again.
Yeah.
I think that they would build a ballpark of 30, 35,000 people in a very good location in downtown.
Yep.
And it could fly. Now, they'd have a big problem. The big problem would be television revenue, local television revenue, and local radio revenue. I don't know how the heck they would do that. They could do it maybe because Bell Canada would come up with a lot of bill, but
sure.
And they would have to make an arrangement with one of the television networks, which would not be tough because there are now several sports networks in Canada they could use. So it's got a chance. No question.
I am knocking on wood. One last question, which I do at the end of every podcast, is I always ask the guests for a nugget of wisdom, a life tip, something that, if I met you at a bar, I'd say, it's nice to meet you. I'm Joni. You'd say, I'm Charles. I'd say, so what's your deal? And you would say,
My deal is it's good to meet you, providing you and I share the same values, walk on the same street, and can really do things together.
I like that a lot, regardless of class or race or any of that stuff.
Doesn't matter.
That's good. I like that a lot.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, sir. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
My pleasure.